I'd like to spend a few minutes talking a little bit about experience and leadership. Newer research has indicated that experience may not be all that we thought it was, and certainly not something that we want to always rely on when we're talking about issues of innovation or change or adaptation to new realities. I'd actually like to build on work that was done by Kishori Sengupta, Tarek Abdel Hamid, and Luke Van Wassenhove in their recent article in Harvard Business Review called The Experience Trap. I'll add some additional insights to the insights that they developed in their understanding of some of the challenges and limitations associated with experience. Certainly in healthcare, we emulate experience and even raise the specter of its value to a level of sacrament. And it does make sense that we do that because much of what we do in healthcare with regard to people's lives and the clinical interventions that undergird our activities value and relate to the amount of previous experience we've had in doing those procedures and rendering those services. What we want to focus on here, though, is not that kind of experience. Certainly, we want as much experience in those therapeutic processes that are well-validated and strongly affirmed as appropriate to delineating care. But we also want to be cautious when we say that, because often what we come to find out is that our dependence on experience limits our availability to changes in that experience. And here is where we run into a great deal of problems in healthcare. This experience trap, if you will, catches us in a frame of reference or a mental model that values our past, our processes, our rituals and routines in such a way that they become a predominant frame of reference for our actions. When confronted with new evidence or a need to change our behaviors, we find it increasingly difficult to embrace that change in behaviors simply because of our experience and our repetitious attachment to what has previously worked. It's almost an anathema to our consciousness to embrace something that reveals what we have previously done is no longer of value when we have valued it for so long. Yet, living in an evidence-based and best practice world, one of the things that we as leaders have to embrace is the inevitability that past practice may be continuously changed in a dynamic of unending shift based on what the evidence reveals as to what is effective, what works, what new technology reveals, and what calls us to new ways of thinking about what it is we do. This whole evidence-based frame, if you will, now becomes a challenge to our own experience and puts us in jeopardy with regard to all that we've done and all that we've learned. When this occurs, the challenge that rises in each of us is the dependence on what we know versus the ability to embrace what we learn. This contradiction appears to be in diverse opposition and creating in our mind something that makes it difficult for us to cope with changing and shifting realities. As we begin to struggle with this issue, it's important for us to be firm in our validation that experience, in the context of not having anything else to depend on, is a really critical value. We certainly do not want to surrender our attachment to experiences that have proven to be valuable and meaningful in the face of no other evidence. At the same time, however, while we are depending on our experience, a part of our challenge will be to shift our mental model into an understanding that experience will never be sufficient. In a world where knowledge is growing at a quantum rate, it is untenable to believe that our experience can be the single most important aspect of our knowing and of our learning. In a quantum world like the one we are currently experiencing, it is important for us to recognize that knowledge is not something that we can own, something that we can have as a capacity. in the old age of learning, in the industrial model, we looked at learning as a capacity rather than as a utility. And the goal was to provide you as an individual with as much knowledge as you could possibly stuff into your head. This notion of stuffing you with knowledge and giving you everything that you needed to know in order to do what it is you needed to do is a model that is really no longer relevant based on what we now understand about knowledge creation and generation. In a quantum world or a 21st century context, knowledge is a continuous dynamic utility available to all, as evidenced by the internet and virtual reality. When we understand knowledge in this way, we begin to recognize that it is no longer a capacity, something that you can actually have. It is instead more of a utility, something with which you draw on in order to access it in a way you need to, when you need to. In this way, what's critical for us is to recognize that knowledge in and of itself is not something you can have, rather it is something that you access. Being available to access knowledge and recognizing knowledge as an access skill requires that we unbundle and suspend our attachment to the ownership of knowledge. When we do this, we recognize knowledge as a dynamic in and of itself, something that we cannot have, something that is not static or contained only in our heads, but something that is continuous, unfolding, growing, and dynamic, something indeed in which we must always be available to in order to make sure that what we know and do is relevant to our time and our experience. When we put experience in this context, it is one of the elements of application that is critical, but it's always moderated and evaluated by the prevailing unfolding of new insights, the availability of new information, and the formation of a broader context within which that experience unfolds. Our ability and willingness to surrender experience when it is no longer relevant is a really critical element of good leadership and providing a frame for good leaders. Now, when we think about leadership in this context, we must look at ourselves as leaders, as creators, if you will, of a framework or a way of being, a way of thinking, a way of acting that makes this notion of the access of knowledge and the development of availability to knowledge and to get the knowledge we need at a particular time as important in our leadership role. Now, one of the things that we're going to have to do as leaders, of course, is to look really critically at how our staff approach this notion of knowledge and have this dialogue that requires a little bit of vulnerability on the part of all players to discuss the attachment to what it is we know, what it is we've experienced and done, and to really raise some challenges as to how we can create in our work environment a readiness to surrender our attachment to those behaviors and to replace it with a model or a process or a framework that makes it more amenable for us to be able to express our availability to growing information, new knowledge, and new directions set by evidence and other best practice foundations. Sengupta et al. Talk about this in a much more organized and systematic way than has been previously presented. They identify that when anybody makes a decision about any particular action that is going to be taken, they draw on their own pre-existing stock of knowledge, and they identify this as an individual's mental model. Now, most of these mental models are made up of assumptions about cause and effect relationships in an individual's own environment and past experience. Now, in this environment, when people observe what happens as a result of their decisions, they learn new facts and make new discoveries about this relationship that grows out of these decisions. These discoveries, people often feel, can be generalized to a number of other situations and are fed back or appropriated into their mental model, helping to reaffirm it. At first glance, it looks like a very logical and systematic approach. People form a hypothesis about the relationship between cause and effect. They then act and interpret the results from their action, and that either confirms their mental model or doesn't. However, the authors identify that the problem here is that the approach is only effective in relatively simple environments, where cause and effect relationships are rather easy or straightforward and can be pretty simply defined. In more complex contexts, such as current healthcare environments, where there are multifocal implications in the technology and the information management, this particular cycle frequently doesn't operate as effectively. There are complications to this cycle, the authors identify, that create some problems with our dependence on this process. The first thing that they identify is that time lags between causes and effects create a difficulty in linking them along specific and clear relationships. In complex environments, when people are using simple, naive cause and effect relationship decision-making processes, participants make more or less the same decisions in the complex environment as they do in the simple environment. What that demonstrates, according to the authors, is that people are unable to incorporate the effects of time lags in their planning decisions and suggests that their mental models were really based on a simple environment in which there was really no delay between the decision and its result. Now, they identify that the length of a lag really matters. Participants in environments with longer assimilation delays demonstrated more difficulty coping with participants who experience shorter delays, which would validate the rather simple approach to cause and effect. In addition, one of the elements that they identify as pretty significant with regard to experience and the trap that it provides is the fact that often leaders begin with a set of goals related to cost or time or any other factor identified with the goals, without realizing that along the way, almost every project changes in its scope and its elements and its experience and applications, driven by emerging realities or changing realities different from the earlier targets, making those targets obsolete along the way. What needs to happen in this set of circumstances is that the manager leader needs to revise those targets consistently and frequently and according to shifting reality. The problem is that groups find it difficult, and leaders find it difficult, to readjust their targets in light of new and emerging information. The original mental model and plan and initiative constantly reappears as the primary frame for their thinking about everything that occurs to them. And what happens is that cost overruns reflect the complication and conflict with emerging realities and the original mental models that were created to drive a project or activity or an undertaking from its original conception. Without changing these conceptions based on emerging realities, the original conception becomes a problem to subsequent adaptation and adjustment. So what the authors generalize from this is that leaders continue to pursue their targets at the outset of a project, even when events subsequent to that outset render the target either inappropriate or unattainable upon its current trajectory. It's not hard to see where that bias comes from, because very early in their careers and their learning and their experience, people have incorporated into their mental models the notion that it's important to meet external targets and to meet them on target. This originating bias is frequently reinforced by managerial activities and leaders' roles. Usually, the boss reinforces the original mental model by reinforcing in the leader the need to meet original targets, to meet cost goals, and to stay on course with regard to the goals that were originally established. This rather simplistic bias, again, based on previous experience, history, and original planning, creates a high level of significant problems to leaders as they begin to confront the need to be ongoing, adaptive, and to be able to predict the need for changing even goals and targets based on subsequent information and the unfolding of new insights along the way. As a result, the authors conclude that managers find it very difficult to move beyond their mental models that have really developed out of their own experiences in relatively simple environments. As we move more and more into complex environments, it requires more adaptation and adjustment to the complexity and to emerging realities related to it. Sengupta and colleagues, however, do recommend that there are certain specific kinds of things that one can do to get beyond experiential learning and traditional originating mental models. The first thing they suggest is that it's really important for the leader to provide more cognitive feedback. Today's environments are rich in information and feedback and evaluation. In this circumstance, the leader needs feedback that provides insight into the relationships among important variables in a complex environment that give us some idea of what's affecting the process and the goal in real time as the goal unfolds. This cognitive feedback provides a level of information that is relevant to the environment, the context, the circumstances of the process or project in a way that helps the leader determine what is having the most dramatic and immediate impact on process. In this way, manager is able to look at signals that indicate impact on project or process at the time that they're occurring and begin to evaluate the impact and effect it's having on process and on the goals to which the process is developed. In this way, through the use of cognitive feedback, a deeper understanding of the environment and its impact on the process and decisions that result in the direction that's going helps influence the process and lead it to better outcomes. It's important that the manager recognize that this whole process of accurate and viable cognitive feedback is necessary to be a regular part of goal processes and project reports, so that through use of these techniques, this feedback can be effective when generalized data from an entirely broad range of different sources from the environment, when combined, give us an indication of the aggregated impact on a project, so that not only one project, but perhaps even multiple projects or the mission and goals of the organization can be assessed within the context of the cognitive reality or information being shared. The author secondly suggests that applying model-based decision tools and guidelines are very helpful in decision process and projects. Their research consistently demonstrated that you simply can't do mental bookkeeping in the dynamic aspects of project management by yourself. Intuition and intention is not enough. The development of software in the past few years that is model-based and helps with decisions is an important advancement in tools that will assure that all of the elements related to decisions and process are accurately considered in a context that realistically affects them. Through use of decision support software, an objective element of assessment is introduced into the dynamic, taking away some of the pre-existing experiential-based, judgment-based, and bias-based decision-making that occurs within the mental model of a particular project leader and project members. Through use of these objective tools, it becomes harder, if not impossible, to ignore the realities that they're identifying along the way that in some way or other will affect the goals, process, and outcomes of a particular decision or project. The third element that they identify is the need to calibrate forecasting tools specific to the project or process within which the leader is involved. These tools that the organization will rely on generate outcomes and estimates and impacts only if specifically allied to the project context, to the local realities that are affecting the decisions that are made within the context of that particular project. So there must be an application element that makes it real to the leader within the context of what they are doing. Individualizing and adapting these tools to that fundamental reality makes them more viable and more meaningful within the process or the directions that were set by the leader. Also, as data is aggregated and generated, it is more specifically relevant to the individual circumstances and experiences that the project or process is unfolding for those that are in it. As the data becomes more relevant, more specific, and more clear in these forecasting tools, then the leader comes to trust them more. And as they become more trustworthy, the attachment to pre-existing, previous, or experiential mental models becomes less definitive and more relative, and the leader can become more adaptive and incorporate emerging realities into the changing dynamics of a project and a process. The author suggests, fourth, that goals be set for behavior, not necessarily just targets for performance. One of the deficits in the process is that we're hooked to targets, we're hooked to outcomes, and we hear it constantly in healthcare, the need to really focus on outcomes. But we realize that outcomes come as a part of the process and unfold within a context. And so therefore, deliverables can change over time in ways that are difficult to anticipate when first defined. So these initial estimates of goals or outcomes or directions don't necessarily make good goals over the long term because they act independent of the realities that will unfold along the way. Rethinking the way goals are set and how they are managed will be critical to the leader's ability to adapt and adjust as reality changes. In particular, organizations really need to understand that estimates function best at the beginning as devices for planning and control, and goals as mechanisms for promoting desired behavior. The authors recommend that when leaders are establishing goals, organizations really take a twofold process. First, they should decide on the behaviors that they're wishing to foster along a particular trajectory, and then they should set goals that encourage that behavior. That way, the behavior becomes more the focus of goal setting rather than the long-term goal itself that may be changed by external circumstances. The organization might decide in a project that it wants its managers to minimize turnover, for example. This can be a part of the explicit goal set. To do this, the leader would have to formulate ways to cushion their teams from scheduling pressures and from the impact of normal attrition. Changing those behaviors has a more sustainable frame for impacting outcomes than simply setting the goal independent of those behaviors. Also, if adaptation is a part of the behavioral set that the leader wants along a particular trajectory or goal process, then adapting adaptation-based behaviors and providing skill sets and models and opportunities to apply those kinds of behaviors can become the behavioral set that will respond effectively to radical changes in the environment, unplanned for circumstance changes, and other kinds of dramatic shifts without creating trauma or recidivistic behavior in groups and individuals. Finally, the author suggests that simulations are very, very helpful in helping people develop the skills necessary to be adaptive and predictive in unfolding the leadership of process or projects. often live projects are not a safe space to confront the inadequacies and adaptation deficits that individuals have as they begin to unfold major projects. Creating simulations that allow people to undergo extensive training and experiential applications that show and demonstrate the conflicts between original mental models and inadequate adjustments and accommodations along the way. This is sound advice in healthcare, where the risks are pretty significant. Using simulations as a way of testing mental models and testing processes associated with unbundling or attachment to them, and also introducing variables that would confront planned for activities in a safe space, creates an opportunity for leaders to take risks that don't have negative impact in real life. As the trainees in this process progress, programs should also increase both in terms of their dynamic relationship and complexity, so that people become increasingly more comfortable with the relativeness of circumstances that affect process, and with their ability to engage changing realities in real time as they are unfolding and experiencing the activities of accommodating and applying particular projects. Especially with the degree of health innovations that are occurring, finding a safe space, a lab, or an opportunity to create simulations or those environments that make it safe to explore and to risk making decisions in a continuous and dynamic flow, provides the learner an opportunity to do so in a way that yields immediate outcomes and results and impact, helps the individual evaluate the processes and their own relationship and activities in them, and gives them a frame for skill development that makes it possible for them to grow and learn and adapt in a relatively safe way. The authors conclude that the problem with learning cycles as they've described them don't just reflect breakdowns in learning and adaptation along the way. What they have demonstrated by their studies and their recommendations is that there is compelling evidence now that simply learning on the job isn't sufficient to address most complex environments today, and that leaders can continue learning only if they're given some formal training and decision support processes specifically tailored to the challenges they would face in the contemporary age. With the onset of virtual reality and simulations, the tools now exist to be able to teach individuals how to break traditional mental models and goal attachments and process addictions in a way that makes it possible for them to confront those with mechanisms that don't create risk on patient populations or in the service environment, but also create a demand for them to change their behaviors and attachments in a way that reflects the realities of their current experience and the journey that they're on as leaders. If leaders cannot address this change in emphasis on experience and being caught up in the experience trap, it's going to be impossible for those that depend on leaders to be able to incorporate into their own behavioral sets the need to change their own addiction to rituals, routines, past experiences, and activities and processes which may no longer be relevant, and they may be unfortunately unaware of the lack of relevance. In an evidence-based era, especially in healthcare, where we're trying to build a stronger value relationship between what we do and the impact on the patient, it becomes really critical for us to understand that we've got to be able to incorporate emerging realities, new technology, new learning, understanding about process, and surrender or attachment to past practices in a relatively short-term environment that allows us to respond to patients' needs in real time. Building in these challenges and opportunities, if you will, for modeling new behaviors, constructing software which supports our change into adaptation and adjustment to environmental shifts in our practices and processes, becomes really critical to our ability to be viable and to sustain our work and our roles. As leaders, especially in healthcare, this need for adaptation and our willingness and ability to embrace and engage in fundamental ways this more fluid, flexible, portable, and mobile approach to decision making, to undertaking processes, and addressing our clinical practice, especially in an era of fast-changing technology, information, and clinical activities, is really critical to the viability of the healthcare system and to adjusting and changing the behavioral patterns of those we lead. In the final analysis, it may be one of the most fundamental activities that leaders can facilitate in our current age as we begin to adapt to the radical shifts and changes in healthcare for the future.